Some of y'all have heard me, and if I had heard me, I'd just get up and go to the back and drink coffee somewhere. I'm C.D. Collins, an alcoholic. My merciful God, as I understand him, in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober since October 21st, 1957. The reason I tell you that, they say in Texas, if you don't tell your birthday, then maybe you don't have one, you know, whatever. So anyway, I tell it all the time, and I still one day at a time, and I'm still very much involved in the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go to 6 or 7 meetings a week and try to pass it on to another individual what the good Lord has given me. It's my obligation to pass it on to somebody else. If I touch one individual here tonight with what I say, and it's been worth the effort for me to come up here. Because I've talked all around the countryside. Most of y'all know that. And I got on my knees up there before I left my bedroom and asked the good Lord to put the words in my mouth. So if I touch one individual, that's what it's worth all about. That's it. I've been involved in this program a long time and done an awful lot of talking around the countryside. I've talked all over the United States and Canada and everywhere you can go. I do whatever I'm asked to do, and that's the reason I'm up here today. I do what I'm asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, of course. I'm one of those that went completely down the tube. Sometimes I don't know where we see any more of them. Bad drunks, like when I come along. Bad. God, when I come along, I couldn't rub 2 dimes together when I come in AA, and all my clothes were in a basket. That was where it was. And I was sleeping in the basement of the hotel, paying $5 a week for a room, so you understand what kind of deal I had. But to go back to the beginning, I think you ladies are really the reason I drank liquor on account of you women. This man nodded his head. I was scared to death of y'all, you know. I was scared. I couldn't talk to you, couldn't dance, do nothing else. But I come out of a juke joint between Lies and Vade one night, and I'll get the first drink I ever had in my life. Come out of that juke joint and they said, "Where are you going, son?" I said, "I'm going home." He said, "What are you doing out here?" I said, "Well, I come here to go juking." Said, "Do you drink liquor?" I said, "Yes, ma'am. Hell, I never drink much." She said, "Come in, I'll give you a drink." And I walked over to the car and had to eat. Some of y'all don't know the moon. I had 3 sitting on the side of the car back in, you know, and had half a pint sitting up there. And she opened half a pint and poured half in one glass, half in another. She took hers and drank it and handed me half a pint in the other glass. I turned up and drank it. I walked about 100 yards and fell like you shot with a 30-30. And the liquor come from everywhere, you know, everywhere. And if you'd had any sense, you'd think, well, hell, I'll never do that again, you know. I don't know about the rest of y'all, but if you're an alcoholic, I think you had to work like hell at getting to be one. You know, you just didn't happen to be an alcoholic. I put a lot of effort and a lot of time and a lot of money in this deal to get where I am today. I've spent a fortune on trying to learn how to drink liquor, and I became a, quote, a good drinker. I was complimented many times way back. "You drink like a gentleman, Mr. Collins." "Thank you. Appreciate that." Some of y'all know that beautiful lady I'm married to named Ida. And I met her back in high school when I first laid eyes on her. I said, "That's for me." And I took out after him. It took me 5 years to catch her. I married her my senior year in law school. World War II broke out about then. Come along. And I went in the old Army Air Corps. Became a fighter pilot. First part of the war, I flew P-40s. Some of y'all remember that Chenault's deal. And I flew P-40s and later the P-47, the Thunderbolt, that weighed 7.5 tons, had a 2,000 horsepower engine, would carry as much as a B-17 strapped to it. It was one of the finest airplanes I've ever flew, and that's where I put most of my time in that P-47. I came out of World War II and went to work for the federal government. There's an adjudicator here in Atlanta, Georgia. They had a bunch of old lawyers that drunks and had a bunch of new ones that couldn't get a job. Now, I talked to a man a while ago slowly. I don't hurt his feeling, but them old ones were drunks and the new ones couldn't get a job anywhere, and so we all went to work for the government, new ones, and I went to work for the government. And they had one rule in our office. I'll never forget it. If you fell out of the chair, they fired you, you know. We had one of the smartest guys we had fell out of his chair one day, and they fired old Rudy. I'll never forget it as long as I live. He died drunk. But it's all right to drink then. If you work for the government, it's okay. No big deal about it, as long as you don't get fall out of your chair. And the thing about being a lawyer, I'm going to hurt somebody's feelings about this thing. About being a lawyer, you can't tell what you're doing. Get a bunch of cases up there, and somebody comes, "Mr. Connor, what you doing?" "I'm thinking." "You can think for a day, a week, however long you want to think. You're sitting and think." damnedest deal I've ever seen. And we'd moved out here to Dobbins Air Force Base, Veterans Administration, and we were in this building when I was called back on active duty in the Korean conflict in 1950. I checked out in jets right away, later within a mile of where I'm sitting. Never been in a jet airplane in my life. They didn't have any two-seaters to fly us in. And I read about it and talked to a guy who flew one, and he told me about it, and it come my day to fly the damn thing, you know, and I never forget as long as I live. I went out there and said, all it's time for you to go. I said, all right. And I got in, they strapped me in real good, and the guy struck a match and lit the fire. And they sent a chase plane behind you. All y'all seen this in the movie, sent a chase plane behind you. I taxed out the end of the runway and got out, and chase plane followed me out, and I got out and I called the tower, and they said, you ready to go? I said, I reckon so. And they turned me over to the chase plane. And he comes and said, do you think we're ready to go? I said, I think so. Well, ready as I'll ever be, I reckon. I pushed that thing up to 100%, released the brakes, and let her go. Pulled it in the air, never been in one in my life. And old, he's following, Patillo's following me. And about 10 minutes, he comes and said, Collins, you better make a turn. You're already in Alabama. Hell, I was clean out of the state of Georgia, just going. And if it wasn't one of the easiest airplanes in the world to fly, I wouldn't be here today, ladies and gentlemen. It's easy. You can fly a jet drunk on a cooter, you know. You sit up at 35,000 feet. Wasn't nobody back in 1949. Just sit up and doze off if you want to. It's all right. As long as the fire's burning, it goes. You ain't got no problem with it. It's pressurized, air conditioned, the whole thing. You just sit there and let her go, you know. I could go from here to Savannah, Georgia in 25 minutes. I like that. I went from here to California in 5 hours, 45 minutes. You're out there flying that thing. Fine airplane. Loved it very much. Through the things. Called back on active duty in that Korean conflict. Went to Apple Valley, California. Started flying some out there. And come back to headquarters up here at Fort Bragg. And had a colonel up there. Later retired as general. I'm going to throw his name. He's not an alcoholic. His name is Douglas. I got up there and assigned to him. Now, he was another wow one. An old fighter pilot and was ace in World War II and all that. And we became big buddies. And we loved liquor. And we loved running around the countryside and putting on shows and all this stuff. We had a ball. But I got orders to go overseas and go into combat. He tried to get the thing changed. He didn't want me to go in with said headquarters. But it wasn't anybody. And he gave us a big farewell party at his house before I went into combat. Over that night, drinking, looking, raising, saying, if you ever been around a bunch of fighter pilots, that's the craziest bunch of people you'll ever be around in your life. They get drunk and throw each other in the pool and chase each other and chase each other's wives and all that. Damn, it's messy. So we're over at his house that night at this big party, and he come over and said, Collins, you fly a B-25. I said, I'm the best B-25 pilot you've ever seen. He said, would you take me down to Columbus, Georgia in the morning? I said, I'll be glad to. I'd overheard part of the conversation. She came over, she said, honey, you can't find no B-25. I said, he's drunk and I'm drunk, forget it. The party broke up by daylight. We went home, out there on the base, go to bed, and I was in there undressed, fixed to take off my clothes, and he drove up across the lawn in his Cadillac and blowed on her. Let's go! I staggered out and got in the car, and we drove down the flight line at Pope Field. I looked out in front of one, there said a B-25. I knew what one looked like. I'd seen them everywhere. There's one parked out there. Sergeant came and saluted the colonel, said, aircraft had to go. He said, fine. Went and fell out of clearance to go to Lawson Field. He come out, we staggered out toward the airplane, got it, and he said, you get in. I said, no, you get in. We all sitting there arguing. The crew chief's hearing this thing, and I thought, what the hell? I thought we'd go back to country club, go back to officers club and drink some more liquor. I didn't think about flying no airplane. Stood there a minute too, and they said, I crawled in and sat down in the back seat, and he come up and said, get up front and let's go. I said, I can't fly no damn B-25. He said, you said you could, let's go. I asked the crew chief, I said, can you crank it up? He said, yes, sir. I said, well, you get in the right seat and crank it up. I got in the left seat. The colonel lay down in the back seat and passed out. I got around, amazed of instruments. He got both fans turned, and I looked around, amazed of instruments. I said, where does the gas go? He said, all feeds out of that main tank right there. And I looked down, so I said, okay, and I looked at everything. Some of the instruments I recognized, some of it. I called the tower and they cleared me out in the end of the back of the room. When I got out there, I thought there ought to be a lot to check on a B-25. It's a fighter, but I didn't know what to check. So I just caught the brakes from my toes and pushed the throttles all the way forward. Everything went up into the green, as we say in the Air Force. It all goes up into the green. That means it ought to go. Everything went up in the green. I called the tower and I said, okay, you're clear to go. And I pulled the cold and I don't know where we go. About halfway down the runway, the thought occurred to me, this is a hell of a way to die. I wasn't even excited. This is a hell of a way to die, you know. Never been in one of my life. I pulled it in the air, and the crew chief, he cleaned it up, and he got the flaps up, the wheels up, and all that stuff. And I headed out to Columbus, Georgia. And if you're an alcoholic, bad like I was, about an hour out of Fort Bragg, the liquor died out. And it dawned on me that I was the damn pilot. Going through the air at 5,000 feet, and I'm sitting there behind this thing, and the crew chief says, he's not a pilot. The colonel's not a B-25 pilot. There's three people on board. Nobody can fly the airplane. And I began to come apart, you know. I told that sergeant, I said, go back and get that colonel up and get him up here and tell me how to get this damn thing on the ground. So he went back and tried to wake the colonel up. He come back up and pull up my head and said, the colonel said, come in the wind runway about 150 miles an hour. Stop the power and it should land. That's what I did. Come to Georgia. I chopped the fire and landed that B-25 down and made a beautiful landing. We went to Officers Club and I had three double martinis and flew the damn thing back. Crazy. Get the thing right off. I left out in the States, went on overseas. And I'll tell you another thing about this beautiful woman I live with. We've been married a long time. I have four children. She's in AA now. We have four children. Two of those are in AA sober years. And other two won't drink. I keep trying to say, y'all drink a little liquor when you get in the program, but they won't drink it. I got a relationship with my son. I wouldn't take $1 million him being in AA because he's one of the finest young men is in our town. But to make a long story short, I went over to the southern part of Japan down to Fukuoka. And I got over and I saw no reason to fight. I didn't want to be there. And I wasn't excited like World War II and all. We're just over there. A whole bunch of World War II boys, all married with wives and youngins. You know, everybody. Got over and was had to fly combat. And, of course, y'all know this. They furnish alcohol to all people in combat. If you fly in combat missions, the government furnishes you a double shot of bourbon. On every mission you fly, that's given to you. You take it when you're supposed to go in and sit down for a briefing. You don't have your briefing pad and put it all down. And then you go fly the mission, come out, get a double shot of bourbon, and sit down and debrief. That's the process. I don't want y'all seen this in the movie, I'm sure. But we got over and we began to do it. Now, I tell you what we began to do. I began to drink liquor before I went to briefing, you know. And all the rest of them drinking liquor before they went to briefing. All us old World War II boys. We left the States with 75 pilots. We killed 37 of them in 8 months. A lot of people don't talk about the Korean Con. 37 of them. Man slept two bunks down from me. He had five children. I saw him when he hit the ground in Pyongyang. Anyway, we got over in flying combat, and I didn't want to be there. And I began to drink liquor because I needed to drink. I needed to drink. I tried to fly one day without drinking, and as I taxied out to take off, I began to vomit over the side of the aircraft, and the tower saw and made me come back and park my airplane. I never had an attempt to fly anymore without drinking. Every mission I flew, I drank. I had a Catholic priest of a name of Father Ford from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I began to hemorrhage from the nose from flying so much altitude, and they were going to send me back to Korea after we moved up into Korea to Taegu, King Tu. I throw this out sometime ago. Sometime there's somebody in the audience was there. Went up at a K2 and I met, talked to this Catholic priest and I began to hemorrhage some and I told him they were going to send me back to be operated on to stop this bleeding. I said, do you know the priest in Nagoya? He said, no, I don't know about Nagoya. Never been there, never heard anything about it. I said, well, would you call over to that hospital and tell him I'm coming over and tell him to bring me some liquor? Now, evidently I knew I was in trouble. I said, tell him to bring me some liquor when I get in the hospital. So we got on the phone, got this Catholic priest on the phone. I'm sending Lieutenant Collins over there to be operated on. He's a Baptist in a hopeless case. Don't try to convert him, but bring him some liquor once he gets there. I checked in the hospital, and this major walks in with that little cross up there. And he bought me a fifth of the liquor every day I was in there. And I thank God for that today, because had he not brought the liquor, I would have gone into DTs in a matter of 12 hours. I've been on them for almost a year on a daily basis. Drank every morning when I got up, I drank. Flew my mission, come back, drank all day long. I've seen guys so drunk they couldn't get in the airplane. They hip him in there, strap him in and let him go. That's the way it was. But I come back after I had the operation. I came back up at Taegu and finished my tour. And came home a full-blown drunk. And I didn't know anything about it. I left the States in pretty good shape. Came home. Got in San Francisco, called out until I was coming home. And she met me in Savannah, Georgia. She and two children. I had a son born while I was in Korea. She met me down there. She and the two little girls, and they didn't recognize me. I left the States weighing 128 pounds. I now weighed 185. I had a great big handlebar mustache. It curled up on my eye. And I drank so much liquor, I could look straight out and see my cheeks. So when I got off the airplane, they didn't recognize me. And I told them who I was. I said, this is your husband. Hell, she wouldn't. She didn't want to kiss me or nothing else. So she didn't want to kiss me. The two little girls didn't want to kiss me, you know. And it hurt my feelings. On the way home, I got a fifth of liquor, and the first time I laid eyes on my son, CD the third, I was drunk. drunk. Come back to Atlanta, Georgia. I went back to work with the federal governor. Live out over in Marietta, Georgia. And go and show you where we lived in Marietta, Georgia. Now I begin to leave for work every day with a drink of liquor in my hand and go to work. I drink on the job. No big deal about that. Drink on the job. Come back and I begin to miss days at the time. Early time I failed to come home for 2 or 3 days at a time and I was busy working. Do you understand me? Things got completely out of hand. I live with a woman. Still live with her today, and I love her very dearly. Let me say it right here. And I love her better than anything in the world. And thank God that we're both alcoholics. Thank God we found a way to live. But I live with a woman that will kill you. And I come in one day, I was getting undressed to change clothes, and she reached into the top dresser drawer and took out a nickel-plated Colt 45, had 6 bullets in it, and cocked it and stuck it right in my dang mouth. Said, "Tell me all about it." And I didn't know which it she was talking about. And I saw the whole funeral procession. I saw the casket, the pallbearers, the whole damn deal. I knew I was gone. My first indication was jump through the window and try to get away from her. She's an excellent pistol shot and still is today. So I fell in the floor and began to cry and to beg and to pray. And I kept saying, "Don't shoot me, you're going to hurt me." And the only thing that saved my life, I put some doubt in her head about what she thought happened. Didn't happen, you know. I'll tell you that right now. And I'm married to one right today, and I tell all you guys that I hit these guys about, I got drunk and hit my wife. Damn liquor would ever get me that drunk. I ain't never laid a hand on that woman in my life. Well, she'll kill you. She said, "Well, today, if I hit her, she'd kill me, you know." But so she, everybody said, "Oh, she would hurt you." I said, "She'll kill you." I married in the bad blood, boy, when I went in that clan of hers, I tell you. Them people in Canada down there, all had big farmers that made a liquor and shot and cut and fought and all that, and they would kill you, you know. So I just never ever laid a hand on her. Now, she knocked the hell out of me, but I never had hit her. Boy, I tell you, come back up here and went to work for the government and have all these problems and things begin to go down the tube real fast. Real fast. Thank God again they did. I'd have got enough of the whole deal. She couldn't handle it anymore. So she left me and went to South Georgia, Statesboro, Georgia, and took her children with her. She would have walked. If they hadn't had a car, she would have walked down. Then she sued me for divorce. I began to have a lot of problems here in Marietta and Atlanta, so I wound up transferring over to Birmingham, Alabama with Social Security. Got away with them. And there again, I believe the good Lord intervened in my life. And most of you alcoholics understand it's been around a long time. I believe God intervened in my life. I began to have problems. I'm in Alabama, and I got a deal over right out of Social Security office. A big air Social Security office was Louis Grill, and they sold liquor, sold them little miniatures over there. $1.10. And I tipped all the waitresses $1 the first time they weighed them, because every morning at 10 o'clock, all these lawyers get a break, and we'd go and sit around a huge oak table in Louis and drink coffee. Now, they put me a double shot of bourbon in the coffee cup, set the cream on the side, and put a spoon there. And the only thing you got to do, you got to remember to blow it like it's hot, and sip it. Sip it. I'd get me a double shot of bourbon at 10 o'clock, another at 12, another at 3 in the afternoon. I'd walk back in at 5 o'clock and pick up a half a pint. $2.20. Oh, by the way, I had established credit with Louis when I got over. I told him, I said, "My wife sued me for divorce and all my funds are tied up." He said, "Well, you're titled, Mr. Scott. You can have all the credit you want." I said, "Okay." And at the end of 6 months, I owed him over $1,200 for half a pint that I bought there. But I began to drink on the job all the time. And there again, I believe God intervened in my life. In my office one day, and two men walked in and told my secretary, said, "We'd like to see Mr. Collins." He brought him in, said, "Mr. Collins," and we introduced ourselves. Said, "Would you ride downtown with us?" I said, "I'll be glad to." I told my secretary, I said, "Evidently got some case down in the little local office they want me to look at." So we get in a plain black Ford and drive downtown in the middle of Birmingham, Alabama, and pull them from this huge crate building, and I got out, and they got out. And when I got out, I looked right above the guy and says, "Birmingham Jail." And I screamed like a stuck hawk. Ah! The guy walked right into Birmingham Jail with me. I got a coat and tie on just like him, you know. I know y'all have ever been locked up, but let me tell you one thing. It's a very, very traumatic experience. They put me in a bullpen at 10 o'clock in the morning, about 100 other guys, you know. The time that jailer locked that door and walked off, somebody said, "Boy, what are you in for?" I said, "The warrant said child support. Said they're going to give you 5 years on the chain gang here in Birmingham, Alabama." I like to die right there. I thought I was going to die in there. A professional bondman came down and bailed me out. I never went back to my office. I came home to Mom and Daddy in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, Mama said the reason I drank liquor is because I live with iron. I said, anybody who live with iron don't have to drink. So I come home to Mama, and all of you have been through this. I come home to Mama. Take Mom about 2 weeks to find out what she had. I come to one morning in the bed, and I hear my mother and daddy in the joining room talking about C.D. Jr. She told my daddy, called him Clifford, so a minute said, Clifford, you load him up in that car, and you take him down to Statesboro, Georgia, and whatever it takes, you get Ida to take him back. Because she's the only one mean enough to live with him. Well, my daddy loaded me up and carried me to Statesboro to see this woman. When she saw me, I don't know, some of y'all ain't got to be in South Georgia. It's like pouring turpentine on a cat. She got to jump up and down, you know. Saying ugly words and all that stuff. And she and my daddy sit around her dining room table in her house down there and negotiated for a week about her taking me back. My daddy paid her in cold cash money to remarry me. And I can't tell you, too many nice ladies, I can't tell you the real story of what went on in the conversation, but my wife would tell my daddy, here's some words. She'd use these bad adjectives to describe in a closing remark, and you're sorry as hell. I said, I may be an SOV, but I'm not sorry. God damn it. I'm always. Now, if you're from the South, sorry is the worst word they can call you. If you're from South Georgia, call me SOV, I can handle that fine, but don't you call me sorry. I said, he's sorry as hell. I said, no, hell, I'm not sorry. I may be SOV, but I'm not sorry. So we remarried up at the Baptist church. Called Daddy furnished the money. And I told him, we talked about the liquor drinking. I said, I'll never drink again. Don't worry about it. And threw and stayed sober about 3 months. And one night we decided, didn't know nothing about alcoholism. Never heard the word alcoholic, anything about it. About 3 months after we started back together. We wasn't getting along at all, but we decided we'd have a drink, try to kind of celebrate. That triggered the whole thing again. In a matter of short time, everything has gone down the tube again. I'm back on it on a daily basis. I get a job with the Department of Transportation, mine cutting grass for $295 a month. That got my attention. And I'll tell you that. My daddy came down to Atlanta, Georgia, and told me, he said, I'm not going to give you another dime. I'm not helping you. I'm hurting you. I'm cutting you loose. And he got back and never did come in. He come up on the porch of the house. And he got back in his car and drove back to Atlanta, Georgia. So I'm through with you. Through with you. And ladies and gentlemen, I thank God again that my daddy loved him enough to do that to me. Thank God for what happened to me because it got my attention. I don't know about y'all. It eventually got my attention. I began to write bad checks for liquor. I began to steal, cheat, lie, whatever was necessary in order to continue drinking. Once I started drinking, now you got to be a drunk like I am to understand what I'm saying. Once I started drinking, I'd do whatever was necessary to continue. I didn't give a darn what it was. And if you were standing in the middle of the road, I told my wife, I said, you can't go get no liquor. I'd drive right over the top of you and never look back, you know. I wrote them checks. I used to kite checks. Some of y'all are not old enough to remember how to kite checks. Yeah, how to kite checks. I had a buddy over in the adjoining town, two buddies, one in Swainsboro and one in Pembroke, where I could kite checks. I'd go down and give one for 100, he'd give me for 100, and I'd go down and let him give one for 200, he'd give me one for 200, and we'd keep reading. It'd take about 5 days to clear the bank, you know. You're using the bank's money. You ain't got a dime, but you're using the money, you know, that way. And I began to drink this liquor like that and charge liquor at the liquor store. I don't know if y'all have ever done this or not. I've sat in front of a liquor store. Our county's dry. 7 miles out to the liquor store. I sit right in front of the liquor store at 7 o'clock in the morning. They don't open till late. And you sitting out there, and you hear the guy that sleeps in there, you hear him flushing the commode and taking a bath and all that. And he finally opens the door, and you saunter in, just like, I just happened to be passing by, and I thought I'd pick up a fist and take to my father-in-law. What you want, Collins? Well, give me some ancient age. Okay. That'll be $7.65. I said, well, give me a check. He said, I got a drawer full of them now, you know. I said, well, add them all up. I'm going to put a big deposit in the bank today, you know. They wouldn't cash. They finally stopped the check cashing all the deal, and I couldn't get any more liquor there. And the reason I'm telling you this story to let you know, because every now and then I run into one. I wound up on syrup liquor. That's where you put cane syrup in the corn buck. Rather than putting sugar in, because if a farmer's buying 2 tons of sugar a month, they know he's making liquor in our area. You know he's making liquor. So they begin to use cane syrup in the corn buck and distill it. It comes out with a syrup liquor. I established credit over on the Geechee River with a guy who was making syrup liquor. $4 a gallon. Now, let me tell you something about syrup liquor. If you never ever had it, it's quite an experience. When you take a drink, you're going to throw up. Ah. Take another drink. Ah. Throw up. And about a third or the fourth time, he thought, want to lay down. And when it lays down, you got it right then. Then you go with it. You'll drink it just like anything else. And it's way high proof, you know. But the damn smell of it is so bad that if you sleep on a mattress, you got to throw the mattress away. So I'd have moved me out of the house in the closet on the back porch. A little one about that big in this closet, put me in there on a cot. She had a maid looking after the children. She's working, making a living. And I don't know about y'all, but she put me in there with a pan throw up in a jug of water and sleeping on that little cot. And if you've been drunk a week too, I asked Bill Gray about it. So he's a doctor, he's dead now, and he was in the program. I asked Bill a lot about it. You know, if you've been drunk a week too, you don't have to breathe very much, you know? And she'd come out of me, come out peeping at window, see if I was breathing, and she wouldn't see no movement. She'd call out, Miss Collins, he's dead today, you know? And I wouldn't get excited about it. I'll check on him when I get home. So she'd come home, they'd both get around peeping at window. And peep for a while. I said, sometimes she'd look like 10 or 15 minutes before she'd see him. Slight one, she said, that SOB's not dead. Maybe he'll be dead tonight, you know? And that's the way it was, ladies and gentlemen. That's the way it was for me. She wanted me to die, and she couldn't carry me back to Daddy because Daddy paid her to have me, you know, so she had me. The only way she'd get rid of me is me die, and she wanted me to die. That's what she wanted. Terrible, terrible deal. But if I wanted out, I began to have problems, and I wanted out. I knew no way out, and we read in the Atlanta Journal about a place in Atlanta, Georgia, who treated people with a drinking problem. It said about an alcoholic, treat people with a drinking problem. And I told her I wanted out. She called my mother, and they come down and got me and brought me to Atlanta, Georgia. I went out on Briarcliff Road, some of y'all know where it is, old Ace Cantle home, when I went frequent, 1957. Went in. I didn't know, and I'm serious, I didn't know where they squirted you water and beat you with hoses or what did. I didn't know what they did. It didn't make any difference. I just wanted out. I wanted out. And I went out there and went to this treatment place and found out something about my addiction. And they called out and asked her to come up there for the family folks. And she said, I'm not coming. She filed for the second divorce, told me never to come back to Statesboro again as long as I live. She filed. But my mother paid her, because when my wife money talks, Mama paid her, and she'd come up there to see me, you know. She paid $450 to come up there and see me. So she'd come up and see me, just see me. She told me, said, don't ever get back to Statesboro. But let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen, when I stayed in there a long time. Extended me and all that kind of stuff. I'll never forget as long as I live. And I never forget this. While I was in there, I called at the highway department. I'd had that job cutting grass. And I called to them where I was. And they said, you're fired, right on the phone. But when I finished my treatment, I went back to Statesboro, Georgia, because I didn't want any guilt about it. I wanted to go back and see what I could do. And I went back to Statesboro, Georgia. Couldn't go home with her. I got me a room in the basement of the hotel. Paid $5 a week for the room. Caught a ride back to... got my job back, caught a ride back and do cutting grass every day. And Ida said she saw a change in me. She saw the change in me in a period of 3 or 4 months. She let me come by and see the children every day. And she finally said, well, you can move back in with us. They recommended Alcoholics Anonymous to me. There wasn't any AA in Statesboro, Georgia. There was a group in Savannah, Georgia, one in Augusta, Georgia, one in Dublin. So they recommended it to me, and I got involved in going to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, let me say here and now that the Statesboro AA deal is the greatest thing in the world in Statesboro, Georgia. It's more of a status symbol of being AA than it is the Rotary Club or the Country Club, because we're the elite group in Statesboro, Georgia, still are today. I go to 6 meetings, morning meetings a week, and probably go to 2 speakers about 8 a week right on the day. I do. Because I want to pass on what was given me. I sit in the meeting every morning, and you wouldn't know this unless you went and know about it like I do. I sit in with 3 or 4 college professors, 4 or 5 doctors, and about 20 women in the group. I like it now. Boy, you women coming on board. That really makes it nice. I love good looking women in AA, you know. That makes all the difference in the world to have you ladies on board. But I tell you, right after I got sober, I said, I'm going to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, hell no, you ain't. You know, why mine going to be no alcoholic, you know? Never. At that time, there was one in AA in Dublin, Georgia. She weighed about 300 pounds. Hair stuck straight up in the 90 teeth and slept in the AA club room. And I said, she's going to join us. I said, no, you're not. You know. But we talked all night, and what thing I'm thinking about, we talked all night, and she told me what went on with her. She'd never been on a drunk as I classified drunk. I said, you never been on a drunk in your life. But she told me what went on in here, and we talked all night. And I said, you belong in AA, and she'd been in AA. She'd been sober 37 years now. And we have a relationship, but I wouldn't take $10 million for today. Because we built a brand new one. Ours was totally destroyed. We built a new one. Brand new one. I love her very dearly, and she loved me. I don't lie to that woman about anything. I don't about you or that you alcoholics. I don't want to hurt y'all's feelings. But you're an alcoholic. Lying gets built right into the system. You lie. It just has come as natural as breathing. When I got sobered up, you know, she said, "Where you been?" I said, "Drugstore, and I've been to the filling station." You know, it's still lying. I don't lie to that woman about anything anymore at all. I tell her the truth. My son began to have problems. And like most of the kids, most of the people now coming on board, some of y'all understand what I'm talking about. Most of them are dual addicted now. You run into people who are alcohol and drug now. About 98% of them on board now dual addicted. I missed all them good drugs. I kind of resented. I told somebody, "Well, now, I wish I could have sniffed some of that stuff at all. Y'all did. So you'd have never made it." But anyway, our son began to have a problem. And he inherited that violent temper that my wife's got. The damn police would have him uptown. They'd call me and go up there, and he'd say, "I ain't going on with him." He'd tell police, "Guy, I'll go back to jail. I ain't going on with him." And he was about to destroy the home, and we finally had to tell our son he had to leave. "You can't stay any longer. You're destroying our home." He got out and hit the road, went all up in the north of Pennsylvania and Kentucky and all around, all over hell. He finally come back home and wanted out. He wanted out. He come into the program, Alcoholics Anonymous. I hand him his white chip and AA program. I said, "I wouldn't take $1 million cash dollars for what I'm doing." He's been sober ever since. He has 4 children. He's a professional man today. He's one of the leading citizens in our town today. When he come on board, one outstanding. We have a relationship. I wouldn't take $1 million. He calls his daddy every day. And he's got him a 6-place airplane. I go fly with him a lot, and I sit in the right seat and he flies. I don't have to fly no more. I like that. One of the most beautiful things I've ever happened. I have a daughter that came in this program. She's been sober now about 8 years. And I thank God for that. I have a relationship with her that I couldn't have otherwise if she wasn't an alcoholic. Now, I just told you about the other two, don't drink. And I don't have a relationship that I have with these two, the alcoholics, you know. And I'm hoping the other two will start, but they won't. I've asked them to, but they won't do it. But the point I'm making again is I found a way to live through this program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I never would have known in my life had I not been an alcoholic. I'm one of the few people, have you heard me say, I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. I'm sorry for what happened back there, but I'm glad I'm an alcoholic because I found a way to live on a daily basis. I'm okay with C.D. Collins. Dad, look in the mirror, I'm okay with me. Okay with me, and that's what it's given me, you know. I tell a lot of people, "I love you." I said, "I don't love you." I said, "That's okay. I understand that. That makes a difference to me. Well, you do or not, I still love you, you know." I found the real meaning of love in Alcoholics Anonymous. The most used and misused and abused word in the English language, if you think about it. I love my cat, I love my dog, I love my car, I love love. The real meaning of love is to love another human being without asking anything in return. That's the real meaning of love. To care about another human being without any connection with them. Say, "I love you. I'll help you any way I can." That's what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. That's what I found. Cool. I have a lot of ambition as a young man. I wanted to be governor of the state of Georgia. Could have been if I had wound up an alcoholic. Had the connections at one time. I wouldn't swap places with Zell Miller today. I'd rather be where I am today than be Zell Miller's, you know. And you never understand that unless you've been where I am. I've been all over the United States and Canada, everywhere you can go. And this program, everywhere you can go. I'm seeing an alcoholic. Come in. We're glad to have you. And you don't know where you're going, to a 2-room apartment or a mansion, it don't make a damn bit of difference. I like that. Acceptance where you go. And some of y'all heard me tell some of these, I was out in Kansas and 2 weeks, two years ago at Topeka talking at the state convention. Anyway, when I got through talking, this guy come and said, "You pilot, aren't you?" "Yeah." I said, "Come on, go with me. I'm going down and take my wife down to Wichita. She's going to catch an airplane and go to New York." Went out to the airport at Topeka. And I thought he'd get a little Cessna 182 or 184, some little small 4-place airplane. We got out and he had a twin-engine pressurized supercharged airplane. It cost over $1 million. He said, "You get up and fly." I said, "I've never been in one like this. I can't fly." So he got in the left seat. I got in the right. Wife got in the back seat. And we headed for Wichita. Now listen to this. As we're going to Wichita, I said, "See them buildings down?" I said, "Yes, sir." "That's the state penitentiary." I said, 15 years ago, I was right down there. Nowhere else would you find that except in Alcoholics Anonymous, what we'll tell each other, what we'll do for one another. Outstanding man day in the construction business, doing real well. That's the reason I'm glad I found a way to live in AA. I'm okay. And the one thing that I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, now, people get all excited about sin. You've been here all this time. I tell you what, I know about CD college. I don't know about you, know about yourself, but if I quit going to Alcoholics Anonymous and working this program, you know what I'll do? I'll go back to it in time. I don't know what the time frame will be, but I'll go back to drinking liquor in time. Might be 3 weeks, 3 months, might be a year or two. I don't know, but I'll go back to it. And the reason I sit in these meetings all the time is because I'm sitting and listening to you people, and you see somebody's in there with 6 months sober, a year sober, out there, and he's saying stuff, and you think, God, what a way in the world he heard that. Damn, I never have heard anything like in my life. So that's the reason I'm still involved in the AA program. And to tell all of you who are new in the program, for God's sakes, don't make any exceptions. You know, I've seen people who made exceptions. And another thing we don't talk a lot about in the program, we have a terminal illness. It will kill you. It will kill you. In our town, about 6-8 months ago, I came down one street and I counted 14 people down that street that died from alcoholism and drug addiction. Did I count? I'm dealing with a young man right today that three of his mother, his grandfather and grandmother died, and his dad is an alcoholic. You need to get court order and put him somewhere, because you got to stop him. Stop him. He's on drugs too. You know. But they're not gonna do it, and the boy's gonna die. You know, got everything in the But the reason I tell you that is to let you know that we have a terminal illness, and if you don't do what it says to do, you can go back to it in time. But I found a way to live on a daily basis where I'm all right with C.D. Collins today, and to tell you, you know, when the time comes for me to go to great beyond, I'm not going kicking and screaming. Be okay, because the good Lord smiled on me beyond my wildest dreams. Most of y'all know I still fly an airplane. I lost it all. I lost my commission right out here. As a captain right over at Dobbins Air Force Base. I took a woman up in a jet one Sunday morning. Me and her both drunk, and I couldn't sign the clearance, and they didn't like that for some reason. I don't know. But they turned it over to the colonel. And next time I reported for a drill out there, he called me and said, "Is this your clearance?" I said, "Yes." He says, "You drinking?" I said, "Yes, sir." I was drinking, you know, something wrong with that. He said, "Not in my outfit." I said, "I am. I flew 100 missions drinking. What do you mean?" He said, "Not in my outfit. I'm going to court-martial you." I said, "Since you've been in two wars, I'll let you resign your commission." He typed it up, "I resigned my commission." I lost my commission in the Air Force. But to tell you something else you might be interested in, when I got sober, like all drunk, I wanted it all back. I applied to get back in the military. They turned me down. I went to Washington. Went out to the Pentagon, talked to a four-star general and told him my story. He said, "Mr. Collins, you go back and reapply." I come back and reapplied. They let me back in the military, and I flew to 60 years old. Still flying today. I went through helicopter school when I was 53 years old. And they said I was crazy, and I was. If you got a lot of fixed wing like I got, several hundred hours, 1,000 hours, and a helicopter goes against everything you know. And a helicopter, you land it, you push forward on the controls and add power. And a conventional aircraft, you reduce power and pull the controls back. And the instructor used to get out and throw his hat against the ground and say, "You're going to kill me. You're going to kill me sure as hell, C.D." I stayed there till I got through it. And some of y'all know Ernie Vandenberg. He was a good friend of mine. We were in World War II together, Ernie Vandenberg. And I called Ernie when I got out of helicopter school. I said, "Ernie, how am I going to get back from Winder to Statesboro, Georgia?" He said, "Go by and pick you up a helicopter and carry it home." So I went by and picked me up a helicopter, carried it home, landed in the backyard. And the city police come out with all the blue lights going and all that stuff. And they got all excited about it. "So what you doing?" I said, "I stopped to get a cup of coffee with Ira." And they got used to me landing in the backyard, you know. And it was okay. The city finally got used to that, you know, and it was okay. And I took everybody that wanted to ride in a helicopter. You're taxpayers, I think you ought to be able to ride in the military aircraft. I took everybody. And I got all food. I was 60 years old. I got an acrobatic airplane. Now, some of y'all know that. I fly acrobatics, do that, and they get all upset over town. When I come over town upside, they don't like that. And I still like to fly and do that kind of stuff. I can't see too well to drive a car, but I can still see the ground in that airplane. A lot of fun. Tell all you who are new in the program, for God's sakes, hang in here and do what it says do. We read a portion of chapter 5 every morning in our group. I don't know about y'all. We read it as part of opening group. And sometimes I pull my unbutton my shirt and run it up and watch the thing chill bump pop up on my inside bone. chapter 5. Rarely have we seen a person fail who is still followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are such unfortunate. To tell you, if you come in and do what it says do, you can stay chemically free. You know. And somebody told me this. I know Tom Powers real well. I got to know him real well early in my life. Some of y'all know him. He helped write the big book. He said, originally the world was never have we seen a person fail who is still followed our path. Never. Never. And to tell you, you know, that's what I tell people all the time. Young people, got a lot of young boys coming on the scene now. I said, it'll blow your mind. It's the greatest freedom in the world is being chemically free. Greatest freedom in the world. I went back to college. I changed profession 3 different times. My reason of being sober, it gives you choices. That's what I like about choices. You can do some things you want. Last time I was in college, I was at the University of Southern California, out in Los Angeles, going to an aerospace program out there. They thought I was crazy, and I would. I sat there with the rest of those guys. I thought it looked like the rest of them, but evidently the guy said, how old are you? I thought it looked like all them in the 20s, but evidently they didn't. I said, how old are you? Who? You? I said, 53. He said, what in the hell are you doing here? I said, I want to go through this program. He said, you must be crazy. I said, I am. You know, that's okay. But the point I'm making again is I had the freedom to do it. And that's what you got if you're in this recovery program, is freedom, the greatest freedom in the world. Look anybody in the eye. And I'm as good as anybody, not any better than I'm as good as. I thank God today that I know that. I've been called at least 100 times by the state patrol since I've been in AA. They call me Mr. Collins. Mr. Collins, you're speeding. Yes, sir. Write your tickets. Okay. But they don't hasten. Hey, boy, get out and get in the back seat and throw you in the back seat. They don't do that to me no more. Thank God. And to tell you, if you do what it says do, you'll be amazed. And I know one thing. When old C.D. Collins dies, somebody walked by my casket and said, C.D. helped me while he was alive. And if they say that about me, that's the highest compliment you can pay a human being, I think. Just say, he helped me while I was alive. That's what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. Pass it on to somebody else, what's been done for me. And that's the reason I'm here doing what I'm doing today. I don't feel adequate anymore. I think everybody's heard me, and I don't think I make good sense anymore, but it's okay again. If you keep asking me, I'm going to keep coming, so don't ask me if you don't want me to come, you know. Because I thoroughly enjoyed it. I've traveled all over the United States and Canada and had a ball and been accepted everywhere I go. And I'll tell you what's the truth. If somebody tells me that old CD helped them, I'd rather say it about me and erect a statue to me on the Capitol Square in Atlanta, Georgia. He helped his fellow man while he was alive. That's what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. That I'll sit down. My time is up. Thank y'all.